From North Carolina to North Dakota, New Jersey to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Winter Olympic Games are underway in Beijing, even as human rights abuses in China continue. Olivia Enos from the Heritage Foundation is here to discuss what can be done to keep the spotlight on those abuses. The nation's current fiscal year got underway last October, but there still is no budget agreement as yet another deadline looms. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. $30 trillion. That's right, the national debt has zoomed past the $30 trillion level, even as deficit spending shows no signs of slowing down. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And they are called Mansion Marxists, socialist leaders who live the rich and famous lifestyle. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College names names on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Despite ongoing human rights abuses, the Winter Olympic Games have gotten underway in China. Here to discuss how to protest those abuses is Olivia Enos. She is a senior policy analyst with the Asian Studies Center at the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Olivia, welcome to American Radio Journal. Olivia, as we talk specifically about the Olympics that are taking place in China and ways that America and Americans can weigh in on abuses in China, human rights abuses, give us a little bit of background. What sort of human rights abuses are at the top of our list of concerns?
Well, I think China is a serial abuser of human rights. Over the last couple of years, we have borne witness to ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity against the Uyghur Muslim minority group in China. We've actually seen between 1.8 million and 3 million Uyghurs placed inside political re-education camps where many are subject to sexual abuse and violence, forced labor, just many, many modern horrors that we thought were relegated to the history books. But we've also borne witness to the ways in which the Chinese Communist Party has been undermining freedom in Hong Kong. I mean, I think we all watched in horror as civil liberties really crumbled with the introduction of the new national security law in 2020. And of course, all of us have felt the after effects of the Chinese Communist Party lying to the international community in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic about the infectiousness of the disease. And so I think what we've seen is that China is not a responsible international stakeholder. They aren't performing the sort of first duty of a government to protect the fundamental freedoms of their citizens. And it's affecting us even internationally. So for me, it was such a shock when the International Olympic Committee made the decision to select Beijing to host the 2022 Winter Olympic Games.
And as those games are now underway, you have written an article where you outline four different ways that we can impact at least the messaging on what's going on here with these Olympics. And let's take them one by one. First of all, a diplomatic boycott. Is a diplomatic boycott, in fact, taking place?
Yes. The U.S. government announced a diplomatic boycott, but I think the Biden administration really had a missed opportunity here. First off, they had an opportunity from the outset, right when they took office, to exert political will and to build an international coalition that might have ultimately postponed the games for the purposes of selecting a new rights-respecting host. In fact, we saw during the pandemic that the International Olympic Committee was willing to postpone the Olympics over the pandemic. The Tokyo Olympics were originally supposed to be in 2020, but of course we know they were moved to 2021. So there was precedent for this. And yet the Biden administration decided to kick the can down the road and waited until the last minute. And they only announced a unilateral diplomatic boycott, which for those who aren't familiar, a diplomatic boycott means that American athletes can participate, but no high-level U.S. government officials will participate in the games, so as not to inadvertently grant credence to the Chinese Communist Party. But we did this unilaterally. And the Biden administration said that the core, like a key cornerstone of their foreign policy was going to be to work with allies and partners. And this was a missed opportunity to multilateralize the diplomatic boycott. And in fact, the U.S. was beat to the punch. The first country to announce a diplomatic boycott was not the U.S., but a tiny country called Lithuania. So I think this is a huge missed opportunity for leadership on the Biden administration side. And I would have liked to have seen a much stronger position, like postponing and moving the games, which would have denied China the ability to host the Olympics that just started on Friday.
Another avenue is for the athletes themselves to speak out, because they have, of course, the biggest platform, the biggest podium, literally, at the Olympics. Have we seen any of the athletes speak out so far?
We've seen a select few athletes speak out, and we actually hosted an athlete this week at the Heritage Foundation, NBA player Enes Kanter, who has been very outspoken in condemning the CCP's abuses and standing in solidarity with the Chinese people. I think, unfortunately, we have seen China issuing threats to our Olympians. And I think, you know, this is a classic case scenario. This is a perfect storm reason for why China should have never been selected to host the Olympics in the first place. They're threatening all athletes if they speak out at all. And so the U.S. government has to make sure that it's guaranteeing the safety of athletes. And if there are brave athletes who are willing to speak out, they should absolutely be commended and supported. It's essential that we maintain the safety and security of Team USA.
Let's talk for a minute or so here, Olivia, about the news media. What's happening with the media? Are we seeing the mainstream media highlighting these human rights abuses, or are they sort of just pushing that all under the rug to let the Olympics unfold?
I've actually been very pleasantly surprised. I actually saw that CNN was rolling out an entire series that is going to spotlight human rights issues in China. And I think that's absolutely the right move. I would love to see other mainstream media stepping up and doing the same, because I don't think there should be a single day that goes by during the Olympics that the CCP isn't forced to reckon with the fact that they are carrying out ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity and persecuting so many different populations. I think that there are people, folks on both the right and the left, who have a vested interest in calling China out because they're undermining norms, and it's affecting communities that people on both the right and the left deeply care about. And so I think that there is a need to be outspoken. I think journalists should be covering these issues daily, and it will require, I think, a lot of bravery to speak out, but I think this is also a fantastic opportunity to highlight the voices of Uyghurs and Uyghur Americans, Hong Kongers and Hong Kong Americans, Chinese Christians, Tibetan Buddhists, Falun Gong. All of these dissidents are willing to speak out, and the news media needs to offer them a platform during the Olympics, because it's a fantastic opportunity to really raise their voices and to spotlight them and their stories.
What about business sponsorship? Have we seen any sponsors pull out of the Olympics because of these human rights abuses?
I wish I could say yes, but to my knowledge, no. And I think this is an area that is really, really concerning.
We have been talking with Olivia Enos, who is a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation, that with the Asian Studies Center, the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy. We've been talking about human rights abuses and the 2022 Olympics in Beijing, China. Olivia, tell us a little bit about Heritage, and where can folks go to read your writings on this and many other topics?
Absolutely. Well, Heritage is a think tank based in Washington, D.C. We work on both domestic and foreign policy issues, and focus on a lot of policies from a more conservative angle, seeking to influence both Capitol Hill and the executive branch. And you can check out all of our research at heritage.org. Again, that's at heritage.org, and we certainly hope you will check us out there.
Olivia Enos of the Heritage Foundation. Olivia, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth. There are still a number of fiscal issues that Congress needs to deal with. We're going to talk about that today, as well as other major developments. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
We always keep an eye on Congress and the budget, which never quite seems to get passed. We have these continuing resolutions to keep the government operating. Where do we stand in that process when we're actually about now halfway through the fiscal year?
That's a good point, right? Congress is supposed to be doing its work on appropriations the end of May all the way through the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. And they didn't get their work done in 2021. So right now, the federal government continues to be funded on what's known as a continuing resolution. And a CR funds the federal government at the current levels that it was previously authorized to do so. So basically, we've got a lot of these Trump policies and spending levels that continued through those spending deals into 2021 because of the CRs. And right now, you've got bipartisan group of appropriators that continue to try to nail down those details on appropriations to avoid a continued resolution. And they're working toward one of those feared words in Washington, an omnibus. And these omnibus appropriations often have a number of anomalies, policy riders that get tucked in there. And that also is one of the key holdout positions of many of the senators that I think are working closely with Richard Shelby and Chuck Schumer and Patrick Leahy and all these other key appropriators. So that deadline is February 18th. And the big question here in Washington is whether or not they're going to be able to come to an agreement that really continues to fund the military-industrial complex and sort of this bloated federal government that has continued to grow even more and more over the last couple of years because of the coronavirus pandemic. There's also a question on whether or not they'll tuck in emergency supplemental appropriations related to some of the disasters we've had domestically, including the major tornadoes that struck the Southeast, especially Kentucky. So we're watching those very, very closely. And if they don't come to an agreement, they can always put another Band-Aid on it and extend another CR for a couple of weeks or a couple of months as they work through the spending process for 2022.
Isn't it almost time to start the process for 2023?
It is. Actually, that's a good point, because the Budget Act of 1974, and this is where I get a little bit wonky from my time as a budget staffer in the Senate, the Budget Act requires the president to propose his budget resolution by February 15th. And so usually the president's a little bit late on that, and then what you see is resolution proposed in the House and Senate, and once they have a concurrent resolution, they can begin appropriations. But the Budget Act also says that if there's not budget resolution passed through Congress, that they can proceed to a negotiated level of appropriations after May. So that's typically how this process has gone. And you wonder how we get to that big number that we hit this week. $30 trillion is where the national debt now stands. That is a huge, huge burden on future generations. And obviously, that's a tax bill that ultimately will come due, or we will have to have major fiscal restraint through spending cuts.
And Eric Boehm is going to talk a little bit more about that $30 trillion mark here in just a couple of minutes. But let's talk about something that has arisen regarding a key member of the United States Senate. Of course, when you're tied 50-50, every member is key. But regrettably, the United States Senator from New Mexico, Ben Ray Lujan, suffered some health issues this past week. What happened there, and how does this affect the operation of the Senate?
Yeah, Ben Ray Lujan had a stroke and had surgery, I believe, last Thursday. And so that news hit Washington this week. A lot of his colleagues were surprised and didn't know about it, and including members of the Democratic leadership. I read that Dick Durbin had a surprise, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that. I didn't know that. And so the reality is that news sort of trickled in slowly to Washington. This week, we also had a Republican Senator, Mitt Romney. At least some people call him a Republican, others call him a rhino. But Mitt Romney was out with the coronavirus. And so it really didn't affect the developments this week of the Senate. But the question is, when Republicans have a majority of senators present, does that slow down the Democratic majority in enacting the Biden agenda? Because Lujan is expected to miss, I'd say, roughly 4 to 6 weeks, according to the news reports that we've seen. And you have the bipartisan negotiations for the spending deal, like we've talked about. You also have major nominations that some Republicans are interested in accommodating, and that includes nominees to the Federal Reserve, and it also includes this major retirement for the Supreme Court. And so when you've got a 50-50 Senate, and we know that majorities matter, it can really slow things down. Do you see senators that believe in the institution and bipartisanship step forward and do what's known as a pairing? It's when they know that one of their colleagues would have been a yes. They say they would have been a no, but since their colleague was unable to be present, they go ahead and abstain from voting and just say, for the record, I would have voted no, but they don't actually vote. And that would also create a process that allowed the Democrats to move forward with some of the stuff. We've seen pairing before with members from the same party. We had a senator miss one of the Supreme Court nominations, and Lisa Murkowski abstained from voting and announced that she was going to pair. We'll see exactly how that all unfolds, but obviously with Chuck Schumer and the Democrats missing Senator Lujan, we will have a lot in the mix over the next few weeks, and maybe potential bipartisan negotiations that can move forward.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as we typically do, let's end with a couple of words about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based in our nation's capital. We have members from all 50 states, and you can actually sign up for free at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
In a record amount of time, the national debt has blown past the $30 trillion mark. And it won't take long to go even higher, as we learn from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
America's national debt exceeded $10 trillion for the first time ever in October of 2008. By mid-September 2017, the national debt had doubled to $20 trillion. That was so recently that it probably feels like it was just the week before last. Remember when Donald Trump threatened nuclear war with North Korea while he was at a country club in New Jersey? Remember that? That was the fall of 2017. Did you see Thor Ragnarok in theaters? That was also the fall of 2017. It was less than 5 years ago, just right around the corner. And yet, this week, the U.S. Treasury released data that confirmed that the national debt has reached a new milestone. Yes, we are now $30 trillion in debt. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're just taking a closer look at this trajectory that the country has been on in terms of borrowing and spending for, well, especially the last decade or so, where we've gone from $10 trillion to $20 trillion, now to $30 trillion in debt. And the trajectory ahead of us, well, it doesn't look maybe quite as bad as the last few years because there was a lot of borrowing over the last few years to deal with the pandemic, but the trajectory ahead is not good either, folks. It does not look great. That number is only going to keep getting bigger, and it's going to keep getting bigger with remarkable speed. But before we look ahead, we do have to look back a little bit. The speed at which the federal government has piled up those IOU notes over the last 15 years is truly pretty remarkable. Now, again, some caveats here. Yes, the response to the COVID-19 pandemic drove government borrowing and spending to stratospheric heights. But even before COVID was something anyone had ever heard about, the operative question about the national debt was when, not if, the country would hit $30 trillion. The other caveat here is, of course, that inflation means that these dollar amounts aren't the same as they were 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but the debt-to-GDP ratio, which is constant over time and accounts for inflation, that is escalating dramatically as well. And the drivers of the debt are still the same things as they always were pre-COVID. It's an unbalanced entitlement system that is spending way more every year than it takes in, and a persistent gap in general government spending between how much money the government spends and how much tax revenue it collects. And those two things are the result of more than two decades of poor decision-making in Washington, where politicians from both parties have been carelessly borrowing to pay for everything from foreign wars to $1,200 checks to most Americans, even people who were making six figures during the pandemic. Even if the growing debt doesn't trigger a default or some sort of other crisis, it will have a material impact on Americans' futures. Higher levels of debt across many countries and over all of history are correlated with lower levels of future economic growth. And that makes sense because a big part of that is that the amount of money that must be siphoned out of the economy simply to pay the interest on the debt will keep getting larger. Every dollar that is used to pay for debt service is a dollar that can't be used to invest in new technology, to pay workers, or to save for the next rainy day. Higher levels of debt also make it more difficult for policymakers to combat inflation, and that's what we're seeing right now as inflation is eroding away Americans' paychecks and savings faster than at any point in the past 40 years. But the Federal Reserve has seen that its hands are somewhat tied because if it raises interest rates, that will be reflected in the debt because, well, we pay interest on the national debt. So it would make those interest payments higher and make paying back the debt, even just meeting the annual debt payments, the payments that we have to make on the debt, more difficult. But right now, there's little recognition in Washington that the debt is much of a problem, and that is another problem. When the national debt ticked past $10 trillion in 2008, it became a major talking point in that year's presidential campaign. Later, after federal spending exploded during the first few years of the Obama presidency and the Great Recession, we saw the Tea Party movement pop up to demand fiscal responsibility from the president and from Congress. The results of the Tea Party years were somewhat mixed, but we did get things like the budget sequestration and temporary spending caps that helped to slow runaway spending, even if they didn't fully reverse it. But then, of course, Republicans took over control of Congress and President Donald Trump got elected, and Republicans completely abandoned their efforts to limit government growth and jacked up spending for most of the Trump years. And while neither party is serious right now about reining in the debt, both are plenty responsible for the pandemic-era spending binge that was entirely financed with the nation's credit card. While some of the $5.3 trillion in emergency pandemic spending was certainly a justified response to a once-in-a-generation crisis, much of it was wasted. States received hundreds of billions of dollars in budgetary aid, and in many cases, they are now running some of the biggest budget surpluses they've ever seen. Direct checks that were supposed to tide over employees whose workplaces were shuttered by COVID also went to people earning six figures who were working from home. Every dollar borrowed and spent as part of last year's $1.9 trillion relief bill is estimated to have generated only 73 cents in economic activity. And that's according to the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, which is one of the few organizations in Washington that is trying to put a spotlight on the problems that the debt is causing for the economy and will cause in the future. The debt won't stop rising when the pandemic passes. Entitlements like Social Security and Medicare are in dire fiscal straits, and they will become even more costly as the average American gets older. Even without another unexpected crisis, deficits are expected to exceed $1 trillion annually, basically for as far into the future as we can see, which means the debt will continue growing, both in real terms and as a percentage of the economy. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the federal government will add another $12 trillion to the debt by 2031. And so that means that it won't be long before we're looking back at this week and saying, wow, it felt like just yesterday that the debt hit the $30 trillion mark. Because $40 trillion, and then probably $50 trillion, they're coming up pretty fast. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the fiscal situation in Washington and everything else happening around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Socialist revolutionaries from Fidel Castro to a founder of Black Lives Matter have grown rich while spouting Marxist ideology. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this American Radio Journal commentary.
The term mansion Marxist is an oldie and a goodie. It's right up there with limousine leftists, champagne socialists, but richer, pun intended, because it denotes an especially outrageous kind of hypocrite. For instance, the Soviet party apparatchik basking in the warmth of his seaside dacha while the masses shiver in breadlines, or the self-proclaimed fighter for the working man who yaps about income equality while filling his pockets with profits pilfered from party coffers. Gus Hall, the corrupt head of Communist Party USA from 1959 to 2000, was a master of that craft, dutifully stuffing his wallet with cash from the Kremlin before daring to spare a dime for his union brothers on the factory floor. I recently wrote a long piece on this phenomenon for the American Spectator. Check it out. Titled Marx's Greed, it looks at cases from the Kims of North Korea to Xi Jinping to Nicolae Ceausescu, who had castles all over Romania. Fidel Castro, for instance, was worth a cool $900 million at the time of his death, while all Cuban workers subsisted off an annual salary of $120 a year. You couldn't own a home or a boat in Cuba, but Fidel well owned the island. Raul Castro, too, is a multimillionaire. Marxism, you see, is for the ruled, not the rulers. It's for the masses, not the masters. When I most recently Googled Mansion Marxist, what popped up were articles about the founder of Black Lives Matter, Patrice Cullors. "We are trained Marxists," said Cullors of her and BLM's co-founder, Alicia Garza. "We are super versed in ideological theories, particularly critical race theory." Patrice is also super versed in buying properties. When Marx and Engels proclaimed in the manifesto that the entire communist theory may be summed up in a single sentence, abolition of private property, Patrice evidently wasn't interested. Quite the contrary. In Marx's Greed, I wrote about the purchase of several new homes and properties by Patrice and her wife in just the last few years. The New York Post broke the story, reporting that BLM's co-founder went on a real estate buying binge, snagging four high-end homes for $3.2 million. Among them was a $1.4 million spot outside L.A. in the canyon, and another lovely custom ranch resting on 3.2 acres of rural woods in Georgia. Also on Cullors' wish list was an opulent celebrity beachfront at a resort in the Bahamas, where her neighbors would be not the proletariat, but Justin Timberlake and Tiger Woods. Well, now there's more. The BLM comrades are literally moving into mansion Marxist territory. A massive 10,000-square-foot, $6.3 million mansion in Toronto that had once served as the headquarters of the Communist Party. Yes, the Communist Party. For the record, Patrice Cullors recently resigned as executive director of BLM's Global Foundation Network in disgrace under pressure from BLM staffers who expressed outrage over her buying spree and over ongoing questions about the organization's finances and exactly how much money she personally pulled in. According to an exclusive report by the Associated Press, BLM raised a staggering $90 million in donations in 2020 alone. Countless Americans wrote checks to the organization. BLM soon had more money than it knew what to do with. Patrice Cullors clearly knew what to do with hers. She also knew how to respond to her critics. Cullors denounces those exposing her as, you guessed it, racist. "The fact that the right-wing media is trying to create the stereo around my spending is, frankly," says Cullors, "racist and sexist." Yes, racist and sexist. But once again, those most offended by Patrice and her spouse's opulence happen to be her allies, that is, fellow members of BLM. "If you go around calling yourself a socialist," objects Hawk Newsom of BLM New York, "you have to ask how much of your own personal money is going to charitable causes." Precisely. Hypocrisy bothers everyone, Patrice, black and white. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, WGNE-FM and WEJZ-FM in Jacksonville, Florida. Welcome to our new listeners in the Sunshine State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.